Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking to my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Gunpowder Milkshake's editor, Nicholas DeToth. DeToth's previous work has included The Commuter, Hitman, Agent 47, This Means War, Gulliver's Travels, X-Men Origins Wolverine, and Live Free or Die Hard, among others. He also edited the pilot of the Hawaii Five-O reboot. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for film professionals of all types. It's so nice to talk to you. My wife and I thoroughly enjoyed the film the other day.
Oh, good. You were able to see it.
Yeah, we watched it last night. It's a wild ride. It is really fun.
It is. It's a genre bender. It's a mixture of everything. The delicious old-fashioned B-movies and contemporary twists and strong women.
Noir feel to it.
Definitely noir feel to it. Yeah, it's a fun ride.
The movie rhythms and the style is really very stylized.
Yes.
Right? As you said, it's dependent on different genres. Does that make it easier to cut or harder to cut that things are very stylized?
I think the style of editing for any feature, as you probably know, is really driven by the story. And ultimately, the script, if the script lends itself to it, then it's effortless. The only time it becomes an issue is when you try to impose a style on a story that is not built for it. And I think that's usually a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. And I can't think, to be honest, of any situations in which someone has imposed an editing style or a pace on a movie or a story that just wasn't meant for that. I can't think of that too often.
Yeah. I just talked to Jennifer Lilly, who cut Master of None. She's cut all those seasons. And the third season is so radically different from the other two seasons. That was one of the things I said was, it's clear that you aren't imposing a style because the style is so radically different in this season.
Right.
She goes, you have to let the film and the director speak to you through the footage. And that's clear that she wasn't trying to impose something. It was being imposed on her almost.
Yes, very much so. And yeah, and I think in this situation, we established the world basically from frame one. And so in this situation, Navot had a very clear vision of how he wanted this film to go and a very clear idea on that this was, from the get-go, going to be a stylized journey. And so I believe that he wanted the first frames to tell you immediately, okay, this is where you are, this is the world. In a visual iteration of the Star Wars a long time ago credit roll, before you even start the action, we're telling you exactly this is what you're in for. And so in that respect, I think it helped a lot because then if the audience hooks in, then you're on for a wild ride. Just sit back, enjoy, buckle up.
Buckle up. There's an early flashback in the movie that takes place in a diner. I'm assuming that was scripted that way.
It's interesting. We went through iterations of this. The original version actually had it as the opening sequence. And it opened on a diner, a girl sitting in a booth, waiting for someone who's late, and that person who's late is the mother. And then the mother comes in and they have a conversation. You're doing this again. This is a habitual thing. The mother's always late. There's always something going on. And at first you think it's this speaks to what everyday life is, you know, unfortunately, with a lot of parents who are busy at work, except in this case, the mother's busy at work killing people. And so she's an assassin. And the thing is that the daughter knows it. So it's not even like, honey, I'm at the office, I'm an accountant. But it's like, no, I'm busy killing people, and so you can't come. So that's how it was originally going to start. But then we found that the pacing of it threw you off in a way where it took you out. You weren't sure exactly where you were. You didn't know who was who. And so they found that it was better to start the movie a different way.
And that was something you obviously discovered in post.
Yes, post and previews.
Yeah. I think that opening scene, and certainly other places in the movie, have some slow-mo. When the mother sits down, do you remember when she sits down in the diner, is she in slow-mo?
Yes. I mean, originally she walks across the whole diner in slow-mo, and Navot felt very strongly about this. For him, this was a very Western moment. The slow-mo was meant to represent the daughter's and the larger-than-life image that the daughter had of her mother. This is someone of importance, and you must pay attention to this moment. And he felt it was a very cinematic and very Western-like moment. So,
is there a key to getting into and out of slow-mo?
That's an interesting question. There are a lot of debates on slow-mo. Some people might argue that it's gratuitous and some people love it. Again, I think the story will dictate when you need it or sometimes a director, but I think it's very subjective. And I don't believe that there's an always or never. Look, there's a style of editing. There's a Zack Snyder, for instance, in 300, where slow-mo was used very well. It was a newer style, a revisiting of a action slow-motion style, which allows you to slow down to see the beauty and the artistry of the martial arts being performed or the fight. And so in that respect, he did it very well. But sometimes it's done because it's to highlight the best moment of the action, ultimately, because then if you went 10 frames longer, you can see where they're pulling the punch. You go 20 frames longer and you see they're missing completely. And so I think it's a bit like panning for gold, really, when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. And cinematically, I think it's very subjective. It's usually a heightened dramatic moment. It's meant to draw attention to something of importance. But getting in and out of it, it has to be accompanied with some gravitas. It has to be accompanied with some either musical assistance or a very crucial storytelling moment, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah, I was just trying to think, like, the mother walks across the diner and sits down, and then obviously the conversation can't take place in slow-mo. So you've got to find that right frame to get from the mother sitting or whatever it is to the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, but even in that, when you do it, it all comes down to how it was performed and what coverage you get. Because sometimes it's more elegant to let her sit down in the wide as opposed to cutting to her. It really depends. It has a lot to do with planning, and sometimes you don't have time to plan it. You think about one angle, but you don't think about the other and the impact that one will have on the other. It may have a domino effect. And so if you're cutting from wide profile shot of her walking across the frame and you cut to the three quarter over the daughter sitting, you know, so over the daughter's shoulder and the woman sitting down into frame, there's a version in which she starts in slow motion, you ramp it to normal speed so she lands. But then depending on how she lands, that might be humorous. That might look goofy. So you really have to play with the footage. And, you know, I hate to be ambiguous in my answer, but I don't think there is a always cut from the side to the left to the over, because it really depends on the performance, the look. And as you know, slow motion draws attention to so much, facial expressions or body movement. And so sometimes when you go from slow to fast, it looks strange.
Yeah.
But I think if I remember correctly, we let her sit, because it's been a while now. It's been over a year. So forgive me. And I haven't seen it in over a year. So there's some cobwebs there. But there have been three movies since. So I'm on my third project since. I'm pulling him out of the attic here. So apologize.
Like all the editors I talk to, they're like, once you start on a new project, you flush all that stuff out of your brain. You're like, that's information I don't need anymore. I got to forget about that.
You do. I mean, it went from Gunpowder Milkshake to a fantastic little Irish indie movie with Aidan Gillen, shot by this Irish filmmaker in Dublin, about a detective, a true film noir detective movie. And then a Polish up-and-coming director is going to Cannes with a completely crazy, like a wild, completely out of left field movie. So there's a completely different experiences. So now I'm trying to remember Gunpowder. It seems like a lifetime ago. And now on a Lucasfilm thing, so it's a whole different thing.
That's a couple of European projects. And this Gunpowder Milkshake was, although a bunch of American actors, was a European project. Do you find that a lot of your work is from Europe? And how do you land these projects?
Well, I started in L.A. I did a lot of work at 20th Century Fox. So I did all the Die Hard, the Wolverines, a whole bunch of stuff at 20th Century Fox. And then I was hired on this project to kind of oversee it. And it just took us to Europe about 7 years ago in Berlin. And we just fell in love with the city. So we decided to stay for no apparent reason. My wife is Australian. I'm American. We don't have a European passport. So we came up with a checklist. Do we have any friends here? No. Do we have any family here? No. Do we have any job prospects here? No. Okay, let's stay. Sounds like a perfect plan. So luckily, there is a thriving film industry in Berlin and in Europe. And I'm represented in the United States by WME. Wayne Fitterman is wonderful. And so bless his heart, because when I moved to Berlin, everything was going quite well for me in the States. We have two daughters, two young daughters, and we wanted them to grow up in an international kind of environment. And so we wanted to give them that. It was a gift to them, really, to be multicultural and exposed to a lot. And poor Wayne, you know, I said, okay, Wayne, just find me things that only finish in Europe. And so, you know, it's fishing with a smaller net, but it worked out. And I did The Commuter, which shot and finished in London. I mean, London to Berlin is an hour and a half flight. So Ironically, though, I was working on a movie called The Commuter, I became the commuter. There's a parallel in that story because, you know, Liam Neeson is on a train. He does it every day for 20 years and he sees the same people, the same characters. That's where the story comes from. And every Monday morning on that Berlin airport, I would get on the plane. I saw about 20 guys or the same guys every morning for a year. And they're coming back on the Friday, the same thing. But anyway, so to answer your story about Europe, it just fell that way. And then I have an agent in Paris as well, Lux Artist, and they work with WME. And so they found me European-based projects. And now that I've acquired the equivalent of a German green card, after living there long enough, they've granted me permanent residency that makes me eligible for European content. So now I can work as a German. So it helps with budgets and things like that. And ultimately, the cost of living in Berlin is lower and the quality of life, in my opinion, is better. So because the cost of living is lower, you can take more time off and spend more time with your family. And then you can handpick your projects and take art projects, and you don't have to take blockbusters, which there's nothing wrong with blockbusters too, but you can do a commercial movie and then you can do an experimental movie. And so it helps broaden your scope a little bit.
I love that. Is that something that you talk to your agents about, that they're helping you expand or consider possibilities, or is it something that's strictly something you want to do?
No, I mean, it's a conversation we have because it helps guide them. But ultimately, if it's a great script, they'll send it. The pandemic obviously was instrumental in me taking this. I feel very fortunate and I'm very happy to be working on what I'm working on currently. This Lucas project is a very large project. And after a year of working at home and not earning the best amount, I called my agents and said, okay, we need to fish with a bigger net again. I'll come to the States. So here I am and very lucky to be here.
Yeah,
as well.
But the girls got their chance to see some cool stuff. That's awesome.
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned was how close you have to cut some of the frame stuff because of slow-mo is and you don't see a punch land. I was thinking about that with, there's a scene in a bowling alley with bowling balls.
Yes.
And I'm like, you have got to know when a bowling ball hits somebody's head that either it's a rubber bowling ball or that they're going to kill someone.
Karen Gillan was fantastic. She really rehearsed a lot to do her action and she did fantastic. I hate to disappoint, but these were actually rubber bowling balls. So, but she's very strong. She's a very strong woman and I'm sure she's very capable. And had they given her a real bowling ball, she probably could have pulled it off, but no bowling balls were harmed in the making of this action sequence.
Good. Possibly some actors though. And that bowling alley fight starts with what is clearly patterned as a Western gunslinger stare down. Can you talk about editing that and making those decisions and how fun that must have been to do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, also the villain himself looks like a character out of a Morricone movie. You put a hat on him, it just spritz a little sweat on him and turn the color palette to browns and beiges. And all of a sudden you're like Once Upon a Time in the West, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, you name it. It's like, he's the villain. All you need is like a little bit of sweat and some flies buzzing around him and that's it. And, you know, even the delivery is intentionally over the top and it's a complete wink to a Western showdown. Even her looking to the left, to the right, the choice of angles. Navot really, really loved the Western, you know, and he was very intent on, this has got to be a Western showdown. This is the classic showdown. This is absolutely the moment. And so it was a lot of fun. And we actually even tempted at one point with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I think, oh no, actually, it was Once Upon a Time in the West.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say, all you need is someone whistling in the background and there you go.
Absolutely. No, we tempted with that and we played with that. But of course, that choice with that look in the bowling alley just didn't work simply because everyone immediately recognized the music and it became about the music as opposed to the story. But still, it worked really well. Absolutely.
That's awesome. So the other tricky thing I would think with a broader idea is the tonal shifts because there's great comedy, there's all this action, there's dramatic stuff, there's sad stuff. Talk to me about trying to determine in the broader scope of the movie how to lay that stuff out so that, one, you're not getting whiplashed, and two, you're not stuck in comedy for 45 minutes in the middle.
Yeah, that was one of our challenges because this is not the most subtle movie in that respect. And so it's quite broad just in its presentation, visually. And by the way, visually stunning. I think our DP did a fantastic job, and we're very lucky to work with one of the best. But also, I think the storytelling of it, it was a fine line to try not to be too over the top, because then I think you tend to lose the audience. And look, in essence, the girl, her father being shot dead before her eyes, I mean, it's pretty deep and serious stuff, especially now in this political climate. You have to be not political, but just contextual. The violence and the guns and children losing their parents, it's a very tricky thing to present in a movie. And it's becoming even more so, I think, with gun violence increasing. So threading that needle between keeping it palatable and not just being over the top was a balancing act. And Navarro and I had a lot of conversations about that, about not being too broad and trying to find an easy landing, a long runway dramatically to be able to land the comedy plane and let it taxi into a place of gravitas and then a long runway to let it take off. But you'll notice also there's some moments where we shift very quickly, where there's like a moment of comedy. And that, in essence, is one of the rules of comedy, is surprise. So when you could have a moment that's very serious and you throw in a tiny bit of comedy, it helps it as well. But we had conversations about trying to thread the needle for that, because Sam's journey is somewhat dramatic, but mainly it's the little girl. Her journey is horrific. And so ultimately, we're also presenting the evolution, or potentially the birth of another killer. Again, this is a highly stylized world. This is not reality by any stretch. This is not meant to be reality. This is not meant to be an example to anybody of this is normal life. And so in a world where there are criminals, there are associations of killers, and they go to the diner and they check in their guns. And some people will draw a parallel between John Wick and the hotel where people leave their guns. You can't come in and shoot in that place. And it's a different world. So in that context, you can accept that this little girl will end up becoming perhaps a killer, but it's complicated. And to quote Garen, in the aftermath of the dentist's office where she's asked, so are you a serial killer? And she says, no, but you kill a lot of people, don't you? And he says, well, I do, but it's complicated. And I think that embodies the movie as well, because it's complex. If you analyze it deeply, it's highly disturbing. But if you buy into the ride and you accept that this is a parallel universe, then it's maybe more fun.
One of the things I love to talk about is context as far as editing is concerned, compared to the lack of context that you have when you're cutting dailies. What were some of the things that you thought you cut beautifully maybe in dailies, or definitely felt like they were working for you in dailies, and then when you saw them in the context of the whole film, realized something had to change, whether it was the whole scene coming out or the scene had to be recut because of the scenes around it?
It's interesting because that's a personal approach. For me, one of my least favorite stages or parts of the process is actually dailies. I don't like cutting dailies so much because there's never enough time. You don't have time to analyze it. You don't have time to really get into it. You don't have time to really focus on it. For me, I was very fortunate to be raised, so to speak, editorially by Neil Travis, who was my mentor and like a father to me. And Neil won the Oscar for Dances with Wolves, and we worked together for 7 years. And he loved dailies. He loved the first cut. He loved putting it together. And though I love the process of interpreting the footage, I prefer the second part of it, which is when you take the jigsaw puzzle and you redo it, mm-hmm. and you can reinvent it, and then you can really look at it. But I think that there's an improvement in technology now where you can actually bring in the video tap to the system. And I find that to be a better process for editing dailies because you can see it as it unfolds. The current paradigm is, for example, now, I mean, let's say we're Tuesday. They shoot all day yesterday. By noon, I get 8 hours worth of work or 10 hours worth of work, which amounts to about 3 hours worth of dailies. So by noon, I get the dailies. I have to look at them. So that's 3 hours worth of looking hurriedly because I know that I have to cut them. So by the end of the day, I've really had 4 hours to cut. If I'm getting the dailies as they're shooting them, every take takes, say, 2 or 3 minutes to shoot. Then there's about 5 minutes to reset, which gives me three times the amount of time to look at that take, identify the parts that work, cut it in, and wait for the next take, if there's something worthy in that first take. Not to mention, I can see the evolution of it as it occurs, as opposed to trying to interpret it after the fact. So back to when you cut dailies, how do things change and how much has changed? Well, on this particular project was the opening sequence. We started with the diner and we realized it seemed like a good idea at the time, but in the end, the flow of it was slow, it was disorientating, it was confusing. on its own, that scene works. But as an opener, we realized it didn't. It just threw you right out of the movie before you'd even started. So that's why we ended up changing it.
The technology you're talking about, I know that there are people that do that. I know Tim Burton likes to feed his production straight to editing while he's shooting. Do you know the Frame.io camera to cloud?
Oh, no, I don't know that one. I mean, in this case, we use Qtake. It's funny because I was always completely opposed to editing, even on set. I was like, no, it's old school. Neil was, no, I want to be as far away from production. I want to do my thing. I want to be behind the curtain. I want to do that. But then on Commuter, there was this one particular action sequence, which eventually was, I think it was 12 takes, which were meant to be stitched together and appear to be one-er. So it required immediate decision-making. And since this was not a motion control camera, we had to figure out if we could stitch these things together. So they set me up on set. Basically, it was a direct connection from the video assist to the Avid. Mm-hmm. And they just ferried the takes in. As soon as it was done, I had it. And so in this situation, when I first arrived, they were doing some second unit tests and they were doing some preliminary shooting, some action bits, but we didn't have the cutting room set up yet. So they hooked me up to something called Qtake, which it's interesting because it's a whole other industry now. And so they charged a fortune for this. And we're now Manhattan Beach Studios, which is wired exactly the same way as Pinewood Studios is, which is where the Commuter was. And here, it's just a matter of connecting a cable to something, which this whole place is completely wired with fiber and everything. So it would be very easy, but they're having a hard time because Qtake has proprietary licenses or whatever. Mm-hmm. So what would literally be a matter of a technician plugging two things and us figuring out the rest. Now, they've hijacked this and they're going to charge thousands per week just to do that. But this technology, I think, is very helpful. And I love doing that for the reasons I explained. So yeah. I'm hoping that on the next project, we can achieve that.
Well, check out Frame.io because Frame.io is doing the exact same thing using those Teradek on-camera wireless transmissions. What kind of temp music, because as you pointed out, like it's so genre bending. When I'm doing a film, I'm like, oh, it's a family drama. What other family dramas can I go grab a soundtrack from? This would be like, okay, every movie in the history of mankind, I'm going to bring in the temp score.
This was one of our biggest challenges. Navot has a lot of ideas. So a lot of it was, let's try this. And also some of the ideas were conceived in the writing of the script and they seemed to work on paper. So reading the script and listening to it seemed to work together. But then when you play them together with the visuals, which were different somehow than his imagination, as it always is, you know, you write the script and then you shoot it and that's sometimes a completely different thing. And so it was an ongoing process. And so I believe that this was one of our challenges because there was one piece that was always set, that always worked, the slow motion finale, the action bit, that was always going to be that piece. And that worked really well. That was one of the great moments in the movie, I think. It's just so delicious and so over the top and the shooting and the guy in the milkshake and the machete flying in the air and everybody being shot up. To me, that's one of the best moments visually in the movie and musically. That's a great combination.
And almost a one-er, or a one-er for a long time.
Yeah, the traveling side to side, it is a one-er. That's a complete one-er. So that worked really well. And it's interesting, and I know you didn't ask that, but I want to interject this because Navot really wanted to cut this movie on Premiere Pro and they fought it tooth and nail. And it's interesting because I didn't know Premiere Pro that well. I am on the Adobe Hollywood Advisory Board trying to help them bring it to the forefront. And I wasn't completely comfortable doing this, but during the pandemic, I cut two movies on it and I had become a staunch Premiere Pro advocate. And now I find myself working on Avid and it just feels like I'm working in the past, literally a long time ago in a faraway galaxy, a long, long time ago, truly.
So to talk about that just for a bit, what has been the course of your career? You were talking about being assistant to Neil Travis. So did you start in film or did you start on Avid or Lightworks or?
No, I started on film. I mean, the first film I worked on was a movie called Eye of the Storm with Lara Flynn Boyle and Josh Brolin, produced by Roland Emmerich. And Roland, who went on to direct Independence Day and all these mega blockbusters, this was his first producing job. He had directed one movie in Germany called Moon 44, but was between, and it was his foray into this. So this was assistant editing. It's funny, I was hired on the job because my father was a film director a while ago, and he had worked on a movie called Superman with Dick Donner. And the visual effects editor on this, his name is Michael Duthie. And I had a brilliant plan to become a director, which involved acting. Don't ask me why, but I thought that was a brilliant thought. See, because all you have to do is just show up, they give you a part, you become famous, and then they give you a directing job. It's that easy. So after 6 years of restaurant experience later, I realized that maybe I should reformulate my plan. I decided to look into post. So I put out a whole bunch of feelers to a whole bunch of different people. And my father was an old school Hungarian film director who believed in being tough on his kids. So he never opened doors for me, for which I'm very thankful because, you know, I stand on my own two legs. And so I'm happy for that. In the process of putting out feelers, I told my father also, I'm going to direct a short. It's going to be my entree. And he said, don't do it. I said, what do you mean don't do it? He says, editing. So what do you mean editing? He says, you have studied acting, because luckily I did study acting for 6 years, so I was fairly lucky. And for somebody who was not passionate about it, I learned quite a bit. And so then I did some production work. I ended up being a production manager on a miniseries, a Western miniseries, The Adventures of Lucky Luke with Terrence Hill. I said, I've learned everything, and now I'm going to go make a movie. And he said, don't do that. I said, why? He says, have I ever helped you? No, you've never helped me. I'm helping you now. Any director worth his salt will have spent some time in the cutting room. And I said, really? He said, I'm helping you. Go do that. I listened because he had never really given me this type of advice before. So I put out the feelers. I was working at a bar, and a friend of mine who worked in production had a friend, this editor named Michael Duthie, who I'd never met before. And so she introduced me, and he said, DeToth, your name sounds familiar. Is your father's name Andre? I said, yes. He said, oh, well, I worked with him a long time ago. I said, oh, that's great. So I made him a margarita. He left. And 6 months later, I get a call. And it's from Michael. It says, are you still looking for editing work? I said, absolutely. So he says, okay, well, yeah, I can hire you as an apprentice on film. Have you worked on film before? I said, I have never worked on film before. So he says, that's okay. We'll figure it out. Come on in. So I walk into the room, who's to this day, Peter Elliott is an editor and has worked on a bunch of stuff. And Peter and I became really good friends after this. But this is my first meeting with Peter Elliott. He's in the corner of the room, winding through dailies on a Rapid, a four-plate chem. And I walk in. I'm thinking, well, I've worked a lot in production. I've been on sets. I should be able to figure this out. I can bluff my way in. So he says, have you ever worked on dailies before? I said, of course. Of course I worked on dailies, yes. What do you want me to do? And so then he says, why don't you do some reconning? And at that moment in my life, the only time I'd ever heard the term recon was in the movie Platoon. And people going on recon missions. And he turns back and starts working on the chem. And so then I say, can you just refresh my memory? Recon. How do you like to recon? So he, without skipping a beat, he says, oh, standard stuff. It's a single-sided 4-perf wide on the mag, double-sided 2-perf clear on the picture. And he goes back to work. And I'm still standing here, like, scratching my head, thinking, what does that even mean? Single-sided 4-perf wide on the mag. Who knows? If you haven't worked in the cutting room, those things mean nothing to you. So he tells me that. And after a while, I say, okay, fine. I'm sorry. Recon, what does that mean? You're reconstituting the film. You see those bins over there? There's a whole bunch of bins filled with trims. He says, you take those bins and you put them back in the film, in the dailies. I'd say, great, perfect, the dailies. And I'm standing next to a bookshelf filled with pizza boxes with numbers on the sides of them, which I have no idea what they are. So I says, dailies, where would the dailies? They're right next to you on that shelf. Oh, yes, of course, those, yes. He says, the red ones are the sound, the black ones are the picture. And then behind me is an assistant's bench with the split reels and with a sync block. Now, if you've never touched those things in your life, which I hadn't, they might as well be like high-tech scientific devices. How do you even open a split reel? So I take the dailies, and I have a roll of dailies, and I have a split reel, which I don't know how to open, and I'm trying to figure out how do I put this thing with a hole. So finally, he turns around, and he looks at me with his deadpan look. He says, you have never done this before, have you? I said, no, I haven't done this before. So he was so angry at first. I said, I will work through lunches. I'm so sorry. I'll do my best. So after about 3 weeks, I figured out how to splice and how to do that. And then for about 3 more projects, I worked with Michael and Peter, and we became very dear friends. And then I decided to make a short film. By then, I was working at a company called Carolco, which is where they made Terminator, and they made Chaplin, and they made a whole bunch of movies. And I was friends with the head of post there, and they lent me a room. And I was going to shoot the film on 16 mil, but 16 and 35 are completely different worlds in post, different labs, different equipment. And I realized that I had no contacts to help me fund this thing. So I heard about this new software, which was coming on the scene, which was Avid. They were trying to dethrone Lightworks, because Lightworks was the dominating the force in digital nonlinear editing. And so I cold called this man named Robert Cloyd, who was the head of Avid sales for the United States. And I said, hi, my name is Nick DeToth. I'm working at Carolco. Randy Harland is down the hall. Paul Verhoeven is down the hall. And Roland Emmerich is down the hall. And if you lend me an Avid, I can set up a showroom for you guys. And they'd lend it to me. So I started working on it. And within about 8 weeks, I went from calling them about four times a week to them calling me three times a week by the eighth week. Because the first week was like, how do you do this? How do you turn this thing on? How do you work that? And then because I was doing a short, I was doing everything myself. So how do you record into the thing? How do you, all these things that we take for granted today were quite complicated and had never been done before because no one had tried that.
So what year was this?
Oh, God.
91, 90, 92?
No, before. No, you're right. It was about 90. I think it was version 3.
Yeah, 90.
It was after, because I worked on a Paul Verhoeven movie, Showgirls, which was with Mark Goldblatt, who's also a very dear friend, a wonderful editor. He was the editor and I was an assistant. And we were doing film and we were digitizing it. And we had a whopping, I think, 50 gigabytes of...
I was going to say 8. Okay.
We had JBODs, 3 gigabyte JBODs. And we had, I think, 20 of those. So we had 60. No, it was crazy. And they were always breaking and it didn't work. But yeah, so I started with film and... Then after making my short, Avid put me in touch with Bill Hoy, who's also a friend, because Bill went to the Neil Travis Editing Academy. And so Bill and I are kind of like brothers. And so he's my older brother, much older. No, I'm kidding. don't tell him I said that. You know, we met and we hit it off. And then Neil was a Lightworks editor, but he was hired on a movie called Moll Flanders with Morgan Freeman and Robin Wright Penn at the time. And they had already shot the movie and they'd already started editing it, but on Avid. So he needed an assistant who knew film and Avid. And I was luckily one of about a handful of assistants who had done both. And so that's how I got into the Avid, full-time Avid and assisting, and then segued into editing.
But now you're strongly in the Premiere camp.
You know what? I loved Avid, and Avid has become a, I think it's bloated and it's old. It's just the problem of something when it becomes too comfortable, when it becomes too much of a leader, I think there's a tendency. Look, Lightworks, I think Lightworks did the same. Lightworks became a little complacent. They were the only game in town. And Avid's become that way. They're not very responsive. And after working on Premiere, ultimately they do the same thing. But how you do it, just the process alone is vastly different. Not different in the way that you have to relearn everything. There is a learning curve, but it's no different than, say, going to drive a car in the UK. You still have to shift gears or not. If you're automatic, you still have to use your blinker. You still have to stop at stop signs, just getting used to the different layout. But what I found is that I can do something in Premiere, I'd say about 25% faster. I could do the same thing. For instance, sound work, it's right there in the timeline. So I can fade, basically I can go from frame mode to mod mode for the sound work. So I basically am in Pro Tools mode, but in the timeline. I can apply a transition and use Bezier curves to finesse it right there in the timeline. That's not even possible on Avid unless you go into a special section, but you have to open a panel, then you have to open a sub panel, and then you have to deploy the... So just by clicks alone, it is truly like death by paper cuts, because you click 5 times and it doesn't seem like a lot. But if every time you lose 30 seconds or 45 seconds, if you add that up over the course of the day and you do that quite a bit, you know, I love to do sound work and I like to do visual effects. And so visual effects, they're all laid out in front of you and you don't need to nest them and you can change each and every one of them right there. You don't have to open specialized panels. Whereas in Avid, you have to open each individual panel to be able to do this. They just started to offer this thing where they're kind of nested on the left, but still it's not the same level. Speed ramps are instant in Premiere Pro. In Avid, you have to rely on the time warp, which messes up the way it looks. The algorithm that it uses to speed things up is buggy at best. And if you change it, you have to render it. So all of that combined adds up to about, I'd say about a 20 to 25% loss in productivity and creativity. Because when you can do something quickly without thinking about it, you can focus on the creative process as opposed to having to open windows and having to move things and click things and render things and wait for things to happen. And so for me, it's just a matter of that. I don't really care what it is, but I find that I can spend more time creating in my day or spend longer days because I've lost 25% of the day clicking things. Mm-hmm. And literally, it's just clicking. It's not even a matter of I like the way it makes the effect. It's just the process alone of doing it. So for me, it's vastly improved. And I was leery at first because of sharing projects, but I experienced that firsthand now. My assistant on the movie Barber, the Aidan Gillen movie, was in London. I was in Berlin. We shared a project via something called Lucid Link. And so to the editors, myself included, who are a little leery about the learning curve, in the end, it's not catastrophic. The leap you're taking by embracing this new software is much less dangerous, so to speak, or scary than it was when you went from film to this. Because going from film to nonlinear was a huge leap. Is a rethinking of the whole process, literally down to the way you think. Linear, you had to think in a linear way. This way, you can jump everywhere. You can just learning the interface was a steep learning curve. For Premiere, if you know how to use Avid or whatever editing software you use, they all pretty much offer the same options. Yeah. And so it's just about learning. For me, it took me literally about a week. But I'm fairly technical, but I think that somebody who is less technical would take 2 weeks. And if they're confident with their Avid, they'll be fine in 2 weeks. And ultimately, it's not 2 weeks of downtime. It's 2 weeks of frustration. Oh, how do you do this again? Where's this thing? You know, finding the paths to be able to achieve the same level of proficiency in one over the other. But to me, it's exponentially better.
Lucasfilm is back to Avid?
They're on Avid. I think there's a fear. There's a systemic fear with innovation, ironically. You're talking about very innovative companies and in a very innovative industry, really.
Well, they have their processes. I would think that's what it's all about, is that they know how Avid works in their workflow, and switching to Premiere is going to be a difficult thing.
True.
When you were in Premiere, were you working on the new shared projects?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
And it basically presents the exact same look as an Avid project. Literally, there is no difference. You can have folders, the subfolders, you can have your dailies in there. The difference is the terminology. A bin would be called a project, so that you work in a production, and within the production you have folders, and within those you have projects, and instead of calling it a bin, you call it a project.
And the production's like a project.
Exactly. The production is a project, and the project is a bin. So that's really it. And it's exactly the same. And the benefit to Premiere is that you don't need to ingest dailies. It reads it directly, and it's non-destructive. So as far as memory goes, you don't have to import and create media. Whatever media is thrown at you, you can use immediately. The import processes, it reads the media and it creates a database, and that's almost instantaneous. So that turnaround is faster as well. I mean, these days labs will do it for you and they give it to us, but even for them, for anybody, it's a faster process and it's easier. It's much more forgiving too, of different frame rates and different media types. It's immediate. And you can actually even read Avid media, which is funny. So you can ingest that without having to create media. So somebody gives you a drive of Avid media, you can read it. So it's pretty good. I think the biggest obstacle is, and I've spoken to Premiere about this, is the, I believe there was a moment where studios have come to both and have said, listen, there are proponents for both. And you need to find a way to play well together, because right now that is what's impeding the process. And so I believe, and in a highly politicized world we live in, it's hard to tell where the truth lies. But in this situation, I'm told that Avid is not entirely keen on sharing their code. So the idea would be to start something in Premiere, and if it doesn't work, go back to Avid. You can go from Avid to Premiere, but the return is tricky. And so something in Avid doesn't like taking it back. So I think that's what's preventing a lot of people from doing it. Because if they could go back and forth with impunity, then ideally, you could have somebody working in an Avid next door, and I could be working in Premiere right here, and then we could coexist, and everybody could work with their preferred tools. So in the end, well, that's what it comes down to. If I'm a better editor and a faster editor with one set of tools, why shouldn't I be able to use it? I remember working when I was at Carolco, we had the Roland Emmerich Stargate. Stargate was working in one cutting room on Avid. Frank Uriosti was working on Cutthroat Island with Rennie Harland on Chems, and he had hired a wonderful editor who actually cut the Ben-Hur chariot chase, the original Ben-Hur chariot chase. And he had hired him on to help with some action sequences, and he was editing on a Moviola. So he had, on one end of the hall, he had a Moviola, then you had the Chem, and then you had the Avid. So you had basically the entire editorial progress, the history of editing in one floor. And why wouldn't that be possible? Why shouldn't you be able to work with a Moviola, or why shouldn't you be able to work with Premiere Pro or Avid? Ultimately, everybody was doing their best on the tool that they prefer, and that's what it should be.
Let me jump back into Gunpowder with this question,
sure,
which is not in the complete finale, but near the end. There's some intercutting between a group that goes to fight a battle and a group that's going to try to escape. Because intercutting is not always the way it is in the script. Actually, it's usually rarely the way it is in the script. Can you talk to me as best as you can, if not about that specific scene, about when you have intercut scenes, maybe concurrent action, when is the best time to get back and forth, or what is a motivating factor to get you from one intercut to another intercut?
It's interesting. That's a very good question, because that was something that was in play for a long time, because originally there were some obstacles. As good as they were, some actors were better at action than others. Not by virtue of the fact that they weren't necessarily naturally good at it, by virtue of the fact that they may not have had time to train for it. And so in some situations, we were asking some actors to perform action bits, and they'd really had very little time to prepare for this. So therefore, the action itself, I wouldn't say suffer for it, but it was challenging. And so the concept is that we're going to have three separate fights. And specifically, there was the Enchanted Forest room, and then there was the Sea room, the Oceans room. And they were two separate fights. Michelle Yeoh, you know, Crouching Tiger, so obviously a huge action person with a lot of training. And then Angela Bassett, who really hasn't done very much action, in the Ocean room. And so and this goes into the getting ready to go to the fight as well, because there had to be a process of, first of all, getting everybody downstairs. We were facing three different things. How to stage the fights, which is later, but also the geography of it all. There's a long, winding staircase that goes down to the basement. They have to load up the truck or the van. They have to have a conversation downstairs, because if you remember, the daughter decides to stay upstairs to fight them. You know, the mother says, "You're on your own, good luck." And then they go down and they have a conversation. The sisterhood, so to speak, the former associates who are now reunited for the first time in years, I have to battle it out and decide who's staying, who's going. And so ultimately, meanwhile, the bad guys are in the truck and they're coming. And so it became a balancing act. And it was a very subjective thing, because we found that if we stayed with one too long, then basically people's willing suspension of disbelief declined. At some point, it's a tipping scale. It's a balancing act. You have to decide how long can you stay in one scene, as long as possible, ideally. Keep it interesting. But when you come back, people say, wait, they haven't moved since then? Why are they just standing there waiting for this line to be over? So it's a fine act between the two, and engaging the audience and keeping them interested and believing that this time bending is plausible. There is a stylized approach to that as well, where you can get away with it, where you can say this is concurrent action. And then sound comes into play. There's sound happening that you tie in the upstairs with the downstairs. But then again, that was a problem we had, because we had to give a distance. Because when they go downstairs and the bad guys go downstairs, one of them goes downstairs. So you have to allow time. It was geographically challenging. It was a big challenge to try to put this all together in a way that made sense. There was a lot of back and forth making it all work. It was a trial and error process, which took a long time to put together, because ultimately it's a huge set piece. From the minute they arrive in the library and the minute they exit the library in the van, it's about 20, 25 minutes or something. So there's so much going on, and so many conversations and so many character-dependent moments that are important to the story. And placing them all really was a puzzle, and it took a long time. But Navarro had a pretty good idea on how he wanted it to do. And then ultimately, there was also a trial and error process where we played it for audiences, believing that it worked the way we wanted it to. And then they looked at it and they said, nope, it doesn't work. This is too slow. Why did they wait this so long? And so there was a process of trial and error. It wasn't a slam dunk from the get-go. It was a process. There was a lot of back and forth in that front.
Are you a fan of previews and what you learn from them and how you learn from them?
I think you can learn a lot. You know, I've done this for a little bit, and as an assistant, Neil and I had a lot of conversations about that. It's like, oh, it's preposterous. Audiences telling us how to cut our movie. And there is an element of that, and it depends on where you have the preview, I believe, and what you ask is vital. Questions can be leading in a test group, in an audience. What is your least favorite scene is one of my least favorite questions, because it elicits an answer. It may not even be a question that people have had. So I think they can be very helpful in the context of clarity, in the context of believability and character development. Otherwise, especially in LA, when you have previews, there's so many people in the film industry now. There's so many people who are either junior executives related to individuals aspiring to enter appropriate position here. There's so many of those that it's hard to read their answers as a genuine answer, or is it motivated by aspirational filmmaking or filmmaking goals? We did a preview on Mall Flanders, and then we had the test group. We had 20 people. Sometimes you get some crazy answers. It's a story of a young girl who's an orphan, and it's her journey to go meet her mother, who I guess you would call her a bastard child, or she's an illegitimate child of a noble son and a prostitute back in the 1600s or something, based on the classic novel. And so it's a journey, and it's a carriage ride, and they go places, and Morgan Freeman speaks to this little girl, and he little by little educates her and teaches her about who she is and who her mother is, and she finally meets Morgan Ripen, and who is her mother, who is a prostitute, who is now come into some money because she married and she had a happy life, and that she's always looked for her daughter, but she was taken from her, and this, at the end she meets the daughter, and it's a happy ending. And so this individual in the test group, in the final group, said, so Morgan Freeman brings, and this is based on a classic novel, it's like Robinson Crusoe or something. Mall Flanders is the title, you can't change that. And so this guy goes on about, like, Morgan Freeman, so he brought light into this young girl's life, and so there's an opportunity here to rename this whole movie. We should call it Dark Man of Light, because you see, he brings life into this young girl's. So you get some of that sometimes in an audience. Yeah. And so obviously you discard or you file it in the appropriate place. The previews can be helpful.
What about actually going to the screeners? Because that's where I find value, is just being yes. in the audience, where you can sense people around you shifting in their chairs, getting bored, laughing
Absolutely.
At weird places.
Absolutely. It's interesting because there is often a conversation that takes place after with executives. And was this a good laugh or was this a bad laugh? There's a huge amount of trepidation, and there can be sometimes from some filmmakers and some executives who will zero in on this. They were laughing there. Was this good or was this bad? And one example, we worked on The Sum of All Fears, which is a Morgan Freeman film as well. And Phil Robinson, a fantastic director who directed Field of Dreams, directed this movie with Ben Affleck and Morgan Freeman. And it's about a terrorist attack in Baltimore during an exhibition pro football game intended to kill the president. This dirty weapon blows up and kills like 500,000 people. Half of Baltimore is devastated. We were mixing for the preview on the weekend of September 11th. So obviously Paramount Studios said, we have to stop everything. We need to put it away. We'll reconvene. So we put everybody on hold. I think 2 or 3 months go by. We do some tweaking meanwhile in the cutting room, and nobody knows what they're going to do. We end up going to a preview. And the movie is an excellent movie, by the way. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's fantastic. Phil Robinson, it's just a tense, great movie about international intrigue and tracking the bomb. And, you know, ultimately, it's finding out who made it and why, etc. And it's very pertinent even today. So we have the preview. And at the end of the movie, you could hear a pin drop. Complete silence. The executives pull us in. They say, guys, obviously, this is too early. This is too close to the bone. We can't release a movie. Al, while we're having this conversation, the test results come back. The scores come back in. And we had scored an 87. People loved it. They absolutely loved it. But the movie itself was so thought-provoking that instead of eliciting an applause, I think people out of respect for the timeliness of it all and out of respect and just out of maybe just introspection, we're still processing the movie when the lights came on, which is unusual. And so, to your point, sometimes you can read the audience, but sometimes
you can't.
You know, it went from like, guys, sometimes you just have to accept at the timing and there's just bad luck and everything. And the papers hit the table. We see the score 87. The guys, this is Academy Award time. We're like, everybody loves the movie. When we went into a completely different mode. I think you're right. Listening to the audience generally yields some valuable information. And it also settles arguments. Is this joke funny? Is this not? Do people love this? Do people not? I worked on This Means War with McGee, and we were doing this paintball sequence where Tom Hardy trying to impress Reese Witherspoon. Tom Hardy is an undercover spy with extreme killing skills. He's using his spy skills, and Chris Pine's are vying for Reese Witherspoon's attention. And they're using all the CIA spying technology to win the girl. They both think they love her. And so part of the process, they eavesdrop on her conversations, and Tom Hardy overhears Reese Witherspoon talking about him, like, yeah, he's nice, but he's just safe. He just feels safe. And Tom Hardy interprets that as boring. And so then he takes her on to a paintballing thing where he proceeds to obliterate the field, some of which are 13-year-old boys with his Jason Bourne-like skills. And so it yields a very funny sequence. And people are laughing, but McGee was, I don't know, is it funny, is it not? And I said, let's just wait for the audience. And the audience loved it. And then they laughed throughout the whole thing. So you can learn from a preview. I'm not averse to it. I think it can be helpful. What is scary is the accuracy with which people can predict the outcome of things these days. The testing and the science behind it is a little bit depressing because I like to think we're all different, but according to them, we're not. And so I like to hope that we are. And I like to hope that sometimes, not for bad reasons, but I like them to be wrong because it proves that maybe we are different. So not as predictable as they say we are.
Love it. Thank you so much for joining me and chatting about this.
My pleasure.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. Also, it's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a Topic-Driven Curated Experience. Thanks to my guest, Nicholas DeToth. Thanks also to Jake Gum for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. Thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. Hey, have you ever reviewed a podcast? I'd love to see your review of this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.